every time you drive over a massive steel suspension bridge, or I don't know, step into an elevator in a high-rise building, you're actually betting your life on a microscopic event.
Yeah, an event that happened years ago, usually.
Right. I mean, we all trust the steel. You look at a skyscraper and just assume the metal holding it up is this permanent, unbreakable monolith. But the reality is, the true strength of that steel, whether it holds up under an earthquake or just snaps under sudden stress, was not decided at the macro level.
No, not at all. It was decided in a matter of milliseconds, right at a microscopic level, exactly as the molten metal cooled down.
Which brings us to the core of our deep dive today. We're looking at a pretty fascinating metallurgical study out of Cambridge University by M. Strangwood and HKDH Padacia.
Yeah, a really landmark study on steel weld deposits.
Exactly. And our mission today is to unpack a microscopic mystery. We're going to figure out what exactly triggers the critical split-second transformation inside cooling steel, and maybe more importantly, how previous scientists got the answer to that completely wrong.
It's such a great story because, well, it's not just about how iron atoms arrange themselves. It's a cautionary tale about the scientific method itself, you know?
Yeah.
It highlights this invisible battle between two main suspects, which are chemical segregation and oxygen impurities. And it just shows how incredibly hard it is to measure things that happen in the blink of an eye, especially at thousands of degrees.
So let's set the stage for you listening. Before we get to the suspects, we kind of have to understand the battlefield. So we need to look at the phases that steel goes through as it cools from a glowing molten liquid.
Right, the metallurgy basics.
Yeah. Imagine you're a welder. You strike an arc, you melt the steel, and you've got this chaotic liquid puddle, but then it immediately starts to freeze. What is actually happening in that puddle?
So right after the metal solidifies, it exists in this highly volatile, really high temperature phase that metallurgists call austenite, or they use the Greek letter gamma to represent it.
Okay, gamma or austenite?
Right. And think of austenite as a very specific way atoms pack together. The iron atoms are arranged in a dense, face-centered cubic structure. So it's like a perfectly packed crate of oranges.
Very tight, very organized.
Exactly. But as the metal rapidly cools down, that tightly packed austenite structure becomes unstable. I mean, it physically cannot maintain that shape at lower temperatures, so it desperately wants to decompose into a looser
Yeah,
structure.
it wants to become ferrite.
It does, yeah. But the transition isn't just instantaneous across the whole weld. The first thing to form, which usually creeps in along the outer boundaries of those austenite grain structures, is a phase called allotriomorphic ferrite.
And that's represented by the letter alpha, right?
Yes, alpha.
So the austenite is the original densely packed structure, and as the heat drops, this allotriomorphic ferrite starts growing at the edges. Now, why should you, the listener, care about these structural changes? Because, well, in the world of engineering, too much of this early allotriomorphic ferrite is basically poison to the steel's toughness.
Yeah, I mean, poison is a strong word, but it's totally accurate in terms of structural integrity. When engineers design welding materials, they want to minimize that early allotriomorphic ferrite as much as possible.
They want to skip it entirely if they can.
Exactly. The goal is actually to delay the transformation just long enough so that as the temperature continues to drop, the metal skips past that phase and forms a different structure altogether, something called acicular ferrite.
Right. Acicular ferrite being the hero of our story today.
Yeah.
I was reading through my notes on this, and I kept picturing the process of making homemade ice cream.
Oh, that's a good way to look at it.
Yeah, like if you throw the ingredients in the freezer and it cools down wrong, or you don't churn it right, you get these large, crunchy, kind of watery ice crystals forming right at the edges of the tub. It's weak, it's brittle, it totally ruins the texture.
Right.
That's your allotriomorphic ferrite. But if you control the cooling perfectly, you get this smooth, incredibly resilient, tightly woven texture. And that is your acicular ferrite.
That ice cream analogy works perfectly for the mechanical properties, honestly. The crunchy edges ruin the structural integrity of the entire batch.
Yeah, nobody wants crunchy ice cream or crunchy steel bridges.
Exactly. Because acicular ferrite, on the other hand, forms into tiny interlocking plates. They weave together in this chaotic crisscrossing pattern. So if a microscopic crack tries to travel through a weld made of acicular ferrite, it constantly hits these interwoven plates and just gets
Well, it
deflected.
takes an immense amount of energy to break it.
Exactly.
So the ultimate goal for anyone building a pipeline or a skyscraper is to control the exact moment those crunchy edges start to form so they can avoid them. And the exact temperature at which that unideal allotriomorphic fairy kicks in actually has a name. The paper calls it the transformation start temperature, or TH.
Right, TH.
So here's the central mystery for this deep dive. What actually controls when TH kicks in?
Well, real-world welds are incredibly messy environments. You're melting metal with electrical arcs in the open air or maybe under layers of chemical flux. Because of all that chaos, scientists zeroed in on two main suspects that could be altering that TH temperature.
Okay, so suspect number one is chemical segregation. Tell me if I'm tracking with this. In a real weld, the cooling rate is astronomically fast, right?
Extremely fast, yeah.
So because the molten metal freezes so quickly, the liquid doesn't actually have time to mix perfectly before it turns solid.
That is the core mechanism, exactly. We call it becoming compositionally heterogeneous.
Meaning it's chunky at the chemical level. Like, going back to the ice cream analogy, freezing it too fast without churning means the cream and the sugar are separate. You end up with pockets of pure water that freeze instantly into crunchy ice, and then pockets of heavy, sugary syrup that stay mushy for a lot longer.
A fantastic extension of the analogy. In steel, those pockets of pure water are what we call solute-depleted regions. The metal has these microscopic areas that are completely starved of their alloying elements, like manganese or carbon.
Wow.
And because those stabilizing elements are missing in those specific pockets, the metal right there is highly unstable.
Okay, so suspect number one is chemical segregation, this uneven rushed mixing. What's suspect number two?
Oxygen. I mean, arc welding inherently introduces impurities. You simply cannot perfectly isolate a 3,000-degree arc from the surrounding environment.
Right, the air gets in.
Yeah. So trace amounts of oxygen get trapped inside the molten steel and form tiny microscopic oxide inclusions.
And here is where the scientific drama really kicks off.
Yeah.
Because older studies research that came out before this Cambridge paper pointed the finger squarely at oxygen.
They did.
They claim that when a weld has oxygen levels somewhere between like 320 and 600 parts per million, those tiny oxide inclusions act as physical starting points for the ferrite to grow.
Yeah, the old theory was that these inclusions gave the ferrite a surface to cling to, which basically artificially raised the TH temperature, causing the crunchy edges to form much earlier than they normally should.
The previous consensus was pretty confident about that.
Very confident. They believed oxygen inclusions were effectively seeding the early transformation. Like little physical anchors that initiated the phase change.
I have to push back on that older research, though, because the authors of our source material were highly skeptical of that claim. They argue that the thermodynamic driving force for these phase changes is just way too massive for tiny little oxide inclusions to matter.
Let's define what they mean by thermodynamic driving force, just to be clear. It's the sheer physical compulsion of the metal to change its state based on temperature. At these specific cooling thresholds, the austenite is under immense energetic pressure to collapse into ferrite.
It's like a freight train of energy.
Exactly.
The Cambridge researchers are basically saying, you're telling me a microscopic fleck of oxygen is going to derail a thermodynamic freight train? I mean, they suspected the older studies were seeing a shift in the temperature and just incorrectly blaming it on oxygen.
Right, when the real culprit chemical segregation was hiding right there in the unmixed metal.
So they set out to prove exactly that.
They did. They wanted to isolate these two variables, focusing on oxygen levels around 200 parts per million to see which one was actually pulling the trigger.
But wait, separating the effect of poor mixing from the effect of oxygen in a process that happens at thousands of degrees in a fraction of a second, that requires a staggering level of precision.
Oh, absolutely.
You essentially have to build a microscopic trap. To prove the old scientists wrong, the Cambridge researchers had to design a setup to catch the exact millisecond the metal shifts from the packed orange crate of austenite to the looser structure of ferrite. I know they used a high-speed Theta Industries dielectrometer for this, but how on earth does a dielectrometer catch something that small?
It relies on thermal expansion, but with a pretty brilliant twist. I mean, we all know metals expand when they get hot and shrink when they cool, right?
Sure.
So as the steel sample cools down from a glowing heat, it shrinks at a steady, predictable rate. However, remember that austenite and ferrite have vastly different crystal packing densities.
Right. Austenite is dense. Ferrite is looser.
Exactly. Austenite is densely packed. Ferrite is looser, meaning it actually takes up slightly more physical space.
So as the whole piece of metal is shrinking from the cold, the atoms inside are suddenly rearranging into a looser shape, which means the shrinking suddenly deviates. Like, it blips.
That blip is everything. The dielectrometer acts as a phenomenally sensitive ruler. It constantly measures the relative length change of a tiny sample of metal, and we are talking about rods that are just 3 millimeters in diameter.
Blimey.
Very tiny. So by plotting the length of the metal against the temperature, the researchers can watch the line slope steadily downward as it shrinks. And the absolute split second that line deviates from perfectly straight, they know the ferrite has started forming.
Because it puffs out just a tiny bit.
Right. That exact temperature reading becomes their TH.
The notes mention they used a radio frequency furnace, an RF furnace, to heat the samples. But the cooling part is what really caught my eye. They flooded the chamber with helium gas to quench the metal rapidly.
Right.
Helium. Like, literally the gas we put in party balloons.
The exact same gas, yeah.
Why use that to cool glowing steel?
Because helium is incredibly thermally conductive. It strips heat away from the metal far more aggressively than normal air or nitrogen would. They even drilled a 1 millimeter hole down the center of some of these tiny rods to let the helium flow through the inside, cooling them even faster to mimic the extreme conditions of a real industrial weld.
Okay, so they have this incredibly sensitive machine. Now they need the physical samples.
Yeah.
And the way they designed these test groups is brilliant because they had to isolate oxygen from the messy mixing. They created three distinct categories.
Right.
First, they took real, messy, standard welds labeled W1, W2, and W3. These have both the chunky chemical segregation and the oxygen inclusions.
And then for their second group, they needed a baseline. So they created ultra-pure matching alloys in an argon arc furnace. They used inert argon gas to completely shield the melting process from the ambient air.
So no oxygen at all.
Exactly. These pure samples, labeled P1, P2, and P3, had the exact same levels of carbon, silicon, and manganese as the real welds, but practically zero oxygen and perfect, flawless elemental mixing.
But the third group is the real genius part to me. To test the oxygen theory, they needed a sample that possessed the oxygen impurities of a real weld, but without the chunky chemical segregation.
Hmm.
So they took some of those real messy welds, sealed them in vacuum quartz tubes, and baked them at 1200 degrees Celsius for 3 straight days.
It's a process known as homogenization. Baking the metal at 1200 degrees for 72 hours gives the atoms enough thermal energy to slowly diffuse and distribute perfectly evenly throughout the sample.
It completely erases the chemical segregation.
Yes. But crucially, the oxide inclusions, the oxygen impurities, are essentially baked in. They remain trapped inside the perfectly mixed metal.
So we have the lineup. We have pure, perfectly mixed metal. We have real, messy, unmixed metal with oxygen, and we have perfectly mixed metal with oxygen.
Right.
If the old studies were right, the pure metal and the baked metal should behave completely differently because the oxygen in the baked metal would trigger the crunchy ferrite early. But before they could even run the test and prove it, they hit a massive snag.
Surface nucleation, a classic infuriating experimental artifact.
The bare metal surface of these tiny rod samples was literally cheating the test. The physical exterior surface of the cylinder was acting like a catalyst, encouraging the ferrite to form artificially early. It was throwing their start temperatures off by anywhere from 40 to 100 degrees Celsius.
Yeah, that is a massive margin of error.
Think about the real-world terror of that for a second. An engineer building an underwater pipeline might be using a mathematical model that is off by 100 degrees just because the metal in the original lab test was touching the air. That's terrifying.
It really is. But if we look at the mechanism, it makes sense. When you're measuring something as sensitive as a phase transformation, the physical boundary of your sample, where the metal abruptly ends and meets the vacuum or the helium gas, represents a massive disruption in the crystal lattice.
Right, the pattern breaks.
Exactly. The atoms at the surface don't have neighbors on all sides. Because of that instability, it takes significantly less energy for a new phase to start on a free surface than it does deep inside the center of the material.
So the surface was giving the ferrite a massive head start. I can only imagine how frustrating that must have been in the lab. You set up this million-dollar dilatometer, you bake samples in quartz tubes for 3 days, and your readings are completely useless because the outside of the stick is acting up.
Right, it ruins the data.
But their solution was so elegant, they electroplated all the specimens with a thin layer of nickel. Why a nickel blanket? What does that actually do?
Well, nickel is what metallurgists call an austenite stabilizer. When they plated the exterior, the nickel atoms actually fit into the iron crystal lattice at the boundary and physically propped open that dense austenite structure.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it reinforced the surface, making it incredibly difficult for the metal there to collapse into ferrite. By neutralizing the surface, they forced the transformation to happen deep inside the bulk of the material, which is exactly what they needed to measure.
The trial and error reality of science is just amazing. You read these polished academic papers, but behind the scenes, someone was panicking, shouting, quick, plated in nickel. The surface is ruining the data.
Exactly.
And here's the real kicker. The Cambridge authors explicitly note that those older studies, the ones that blamed oxygen, they likely didn't realize their surfaces were cheating.
Yeah.
The old scientists were measuring a surface glitch and just confidently blaming it on oxygen.
Data is only as good as the methodology used to capture it. Those older dielotometric curves were likely nonlinear before the internal transformation even began, entirely due to surface effects.
So, with the surface glitch neutralized by the nickel plating, they finally ran the cooling tests. Let's look at the verdict. They have the pure metal with no oxygen and the baked metal with perfect mixing but 200 parts per million of oxygen. Please tell me the machine caught them acting exactly the same.
The results completely overturned the old consensus. When they plotted the continuous cooling transformation diagrams, which are essentially roadmaps showing exactly when the structure changes at different cooling speeds, the ultra-pure alloys and the homogenized baked welds showed the exact same transformation start temperatures.
They matched perfectly.
Perfectly. This proves definitively that oxygen concentration, at least up to 200 parts per million, has virtually no effect on when that brittle allotriomorphic ferrite starts forming.
So the oxide inclusions do not act as physical anchors.
No. The thermodynamic driving force simply overwhelms them. The old studies were fundamentally incorrect.
Wow, so oxygen was completely innocent. Which leaves suspect number one, chemical segregation.
Right. The unhomogenized welds, the raw, real-world, messy ones that still had those solute-depleted regions, saw their transformation start temperatures jump significantly.
By how much?
Typically 30 to 60 degrees Celsius higher than the perfectly mixed sample.
A 60-degree shift.
Yeah.
Just because the metal cooled too fast to mix evenly, those microscopic pockets starved of alloys were incredibly unstable.
Mm-hmm.
So they collapsed into ferrite much faster, raising the overall start temperature for the entire weld and ruining the internal structure.
It was the lack of chemical homogeneity pulling the trigger all along.
Identifying the true cause is incredible, but to be useful to the people actually building our world, engineers have to be able to predict this behavior without running a dielotometer test every single time, right?
It's the ultimate goal, yes.
The paper relies on a mathematical concept called the additive reaction rule.
Mm.
As I understand it, they're trying to take this smooth, incredibly rapid cooling process and chop it up into tiny freeze frame snapshots to calculate when the metal will break into ferrite. Does that kind of math actually work?
Conceptually, it's a brilliant workaround. Predicting how steel transforms when you hold it at one single constant temperature, which is an isothermal state, is relatively straightforward to calculate. But as we established, real welds don't sit at one temperature. They plummet continuously.
Right.
So the additive reaction rule serves as a mathematical bridge. It treats a smooth, continuous cooling slope, like a staircase made of tiny, instantaneous flat ledges.
So they slice the continuous plunge into 1,000 tiny isothermal steps.
Exactly that. The rule argues that if you spend a tiny fraction of a second at one temperature step, you consume a specific fraction of the time required to trigger the transformation at that temperature. You calculate that fraction, then move down to the next step on the cooling staircase and calculate the next fraction.
And you just keep adding those fractions up.
Yes. When the sum of all those tiny fractions reaches exactly one, the math says the transformation begins.
Okay, the staircase concept makes sense. But I noticed a pretty big flaw when reading their results. The authors admit that this mathematical staircase systematically underestimates the real start temperature.
It does, yes.
The math says the transformation should happen about 10 to 20 degrees lower than the physical dielotometer proves it actually does. Isn't that a failure of the math? If the model is 20 degrees off, why are we trusting it?
It is a totally valid criticism, but we have to look at the engineering consequences of that 20-degree underestimation. The researchers took that error and calculated its impact on a real-world scenario, a manual metal arc weld.
Okay.
They found that a 20-degree shift at that specific stage of cooling only changes the calculated volume of that brittle allotriomorphic ferrite by a minuscule amount. Specifically, it shifted the volume fraction from 0.38 to 0.37.
Oh, so a 20-degree temperature error only changes the actual physical amount of bad ferrite by 1/100th.
Precisely, because the rate at which ferrite forms right at that boundary temperature is incredibly slow. A small temperature discrepancy barely moves the needle on the final physical structure of the steel.
I see.
So while the additive reaction rule isn't flawless at a purely theoretical level, it is highly functional. In the grand scheme of programming commercial welding software, the theory is more than robust enough to rely on.
And that brings us to the ultimate question for you listening to this right now. Why should you care about the mathematical rules governing microscopic austenite crystals? What does a 60-degree shift in chemical segregation mean for your everyday life? We have to bring it back to that suspension bridge we talked about at the start.
Well, understanding that microscopic segregation, not oxygen, is the true trigger is exactly what allows modern engineers to computationally design the welding consumables used across the globe.
Right. They aren't mixing metals by trial and error anymore. When a manufacturing company formulates the core of a welding wire that's going to be used to fuse the steel beams of a 100-story skyscraper or an offshore oil rig, they run the chemical mixtures through computer models first to predict how they will behave.
And those vital computer models are built using the exact mathematical foundations validated in this Cambridge study.
Wow.
If those models still incorrectly blamed oxygen inclusions, or if they failed to account for how solute-depleted regions raise the transformation temperature by 60 degrees, engineers would be formulating alloys completely blind.
They might unintentionally design a wire that produces far too much allotriomorphic ferrite.
Exactly, resulting in brittle welds that eventually shatter under the stress of high winds or heavy traffic.
It is the literal difference between a skyscraper swaying safely in an earthquake and one that suffers catastrophic structural failure. The macro world we navigate every day is completely reliant on researchers catching microscopic details.
It reinforces a pretty humbling reality. Our massive physical infrastructure is entirely built upon the rigorous, often frustrating, trial and error discovery of the invisible world.
Which leaves us with a final, lingering thought to mull over. In this deep dive, we saw how previous researchers confidently published incorrect conclusions. They built an entire theoretical framework blaming oxygen, simply because they didn't realize the physical exterior of their samples was acting as a catalyst and throwing off their thermometers.
Yeah, a massive oversight.
They had a microscopic blind spot. And it makes you wonder, what other foundational materials or even entirely different scientific systems in our modern world are currently built on mathematical models derived from slightly misinterpreted lab data?
It's an unsettling question for sure, but a necessary one. Science is a continuous process of course correcting its own blind spots.
It really is. So the next time you drive over a massive steel bridge, take a second to appreciate not just the giant steel cables, but the incredible, invisible battle of chemistry and temperature that took place inside them. In the few seconds, it took that metal to cool down.
And perhaps appreciate the researchers who figured out they needed to wrap their samples in a microscopic blanket of nickel just to find the truth.
Absolutely. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning what you know.